Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, financial statement analysis. And this will be kind of a narrow focus lecture, but it will have a lot of moving parts within that compact region. And some of it, like the part about taxes, I will go into more detail than you need to worry about for an exam. I am not an accountant, and I'm certainly not a tax accountant. I will focus only on what is important for us in finance, and that's because what we care about is how much is this going to cost us. Not all the nuances and the ins and outs of it, that's someone else's wheelhouse. What we care about in finance is, okay, there's going to be taxes, that's money, real money out of our pockets, so let's talk about what that means in terms of finance. But first, we're going to have a look at the numbers, and I'll be saying a few things about what's going on. One thing is about spectacular, and it's just almost like this can't be happening. But anyway, over on the other side of the world, the Tokyo Exchange took a slap today. It wasn't a big one. It was 0.75% or so down, about 0.75% down on the Nikkei 225. There's been talk over the last, I think, probably a year or more, that Japan is sort of teetering on the brink of a mild recession. And so it seems like, I don't know, we don't see it really happening, but the market definitely was bearish today over there in Tokyo. On the other hand, as is usually the case, you see the Hang Seng going through the roof. I mean, it was up more than 2.5%. Now, anything above 1% is a really good day. And this one, up 2.5%, more than 2.5%. So this is just further evidence of the power, economic power of the world shifting away. Essentially, the rest of the world is just kind of, okay, we're just going to run the world and run it well without worrying about the United States anymore as part of the equation. They didn't want to play the way that civilized countries want to play, and so everyone else is going to benefit from that. There will be bad days and there will be good days in the global markets, but you will probably see the giants like China, India, places like that, having a lot more good days and bad days because we've just handed them all these markets that we want to simply cut off, insult, and slap tariffs on. And that's just the way it is. Look at the numbers, data over dogma. Just look at how the numbers are flowing around the world these days. Now, this was not a big day for in Europe, the CAC 40 on the Paris, 40 companies on the Paris Exchange. They were down about a little more than 1%. It was definitely a bear day, and you can see from some of the other ones that it was a bear day. I should mention here, and I am doing a little more look into these. You can't look at every possible number and know exactly what it means, not even the best of us. But the Euronext seems to be a comprehensive measure of European bourses, European exchanges. And so I'm going to be, once I understand more about how it functions, I will bring that into our look at the numbers here over the next couple of weeks. But of course, the FTSE, London's 100 companies on the London Exchange, down 0.5%. So it was definitely a bearish day in Europe and Great Britain. It wasn't a spectacularly down day, but it was a bearish day. Coming over here, our markets are pretty, I think we're closed. No, we're not closed there. We're still trading, but we're near the end of the day here in the United States. And there's really nothing to talk about today. The Dow was up just a tiny 1.01%. That's meaningless. It's essentially, it was a flat day, not up or down. Similarly, the S&P 500, up 0.01%. That's the same as saying nothing happened. And even the the NASDAQ was up a little more, but that's the NASDAQ. It was up more than a quarter of a percent. Enough that we can say, okay, that was a mildly bullish day. It wasn't a bull saying moo. It was a bull saying moo. So it was a bull day, though. Let me go down here. Let me talk about things here. Gold. It's now at $5,347 an ounce. I'm not sure I would want to go so far as to say that it will reach 6,000 by the time you come back from spring break, but it's going to make a run for it. The gold investors, what we call the gold bugs, are absolutely convinced that there's going to be an economic apocalypse any day now. Are they right? Well, they're just one set of investors. There are other investors who see nothing but wonderful bull market ahead. It's just, one or the other. And the gold bugs, I don't think I would have ever imagined 10 years ago talking about $6,000 an ounce on gold. But here we are. You are right in the shock front of just essentially an epic change in the world markets, in the world's geopolitical dynamics. It's yours. And you're seeing something I would not have taught in classes ever in my 46 years before now, that we are seeing these kinds of epic movements of markets and realignments of alliances and stuff like that. But here we are. Crude is actually showing a little bit of signs of life. And so it's obviously Brent, a little more expensive oil. And the best that I can get is that there is a little bit more concern about a conflict in the Middle East. In the last 24 hours, the White House and Iran's mullahs have exchanged some pretty bellicose, warlike words with each other. Now, that's just shaking the markets. Okay, there's a small probability times what would happen to the price of oil if there were a war. So in other words, this is a small probability of a large-scale price movement, and that bumps the market up a little bit, in this case, maybe up a couple of bucks. But it does seem to be edging upward. You'll see maybe a little bit more expensive gas, but it's just a little bit of concern right now that there could be a conflict. And if there is a conflict in the Middle East involving Iran and the United States, the price of oil will find $100 a barrel. Is that going to happen? It's a very low probability. We're hoping that cooler heads will prevail. Everyone's just talking a tough game, and then they'll settle down and negotiate. We'll just have to see. Stay tuned for either a normal, boring year ahead or World War III. It's a roll of the dice right now. Not to scare you, but just to scare you. I want to get into the exchange rates, but I won't do that today. I will do that in a subsequent lecture, because the exchange rates are part of this matrix of information that is telling us that the world is really, truly realigning itself. The dollar is depreciating against major currency, all of the major currencies. It's just falling. It's in almost free fall. And I was actually, when I teach international finance, and yesterday, 2 days ago, I showed them just all these exchange rates, and I didn't even realize how far the dollar had slid against the euro, the yen, the rupee, you name it. The dollar is just eroding fast. across the globe. And again, this is not politics, this is not opinions, the hard numbers of real world traders by the thousands, tens of thousands in the currency exchange markets. It's the consensus of their buys and sells that is what these numbers are about. So I want to emphasize that as time goes on. These numbers are not opinions. They are greed expressing itself quantitatively. Now, I'm going to show you a stock, which is the one that I will use as the example for today. I go through stocks, and some things that I want to do is show you a set of financial statements that are not crazy weird. There's nothing really strange about them. They got nice normal numbers and all of that kind of stuff. They got maybe an interesting backstory to those numbers. Here's a problem that has come up, and I can't recall whether I've told you about this or not, but a couple of things going on here. For decades, I would pull up financial statements and I'd know exactly what I was looking at. Okay, this is the income statement, this is the balance sheet, this is the statement of cash flows. I would also look at the rows, you know, cost of goods, revenues, cost of goods sold, salaries, wages and salaries, advertising, meals and entertainment, all those kind of things. And then something odd happened. It was probably about 2 years ago, maybe. I pulled up a set of financial statements and I couldn't even tell which one was the income statement or the balance sheet because they had different names. I thought, well, the hell with that. I just took it down, pulled up another set of financial statements. They had odd names. They didn't, not the same names as the other one did. And I started looking through, right in front of a class, I was looking through, where the heck is this, which line is the one I want to talk about? They were using different names for the same lines, the same rows. And as I did research, it seems that the whole system of standardized names for different entries, standardized names for the actual sheets themselves, has gone away. So one set of financials might say income statement. Another one might say consolidated statement of operations. Another might say something else. Even the rows were not giving the same words. And some financial statements were even eliminating rows that are kind of important, like gross income. On half of the income statements I was looking at, they didn't have the gross income line. Some of them had the depreciation expense line, some didn't have it. It seems that the whole oversight of what is right and wrong to do has just kind of gone away. So I want to make sure that I'm showing you and telling you giving you a little warning about, well, this is what you might have heard was like operating income. You might hear that as earnings before interest and taxes. You might hear it as something else. You might hardly ever do you anymore see a breakdown of the operating expenses. They just call them sales, general, and administrative expenses, SG&A. So I will be guiding you through that. And I found a company that looks pretty good, and it's also got an interesting backstory. So first, looking at the numbers of this company, and this is This is a company that the company is called Palantir, and I'm going to look at its market numbers just to start it off with. Some of you may not have ever heard of Palantir, but it has and will have more effect on your lives in the society than about any other company that I could show you. And I'll try it real quick. Madam, do you know what Palantir does? How about you, sir? I could go around the room. Does anyone know what Palantir does? Just raise your hand if you do. You got a kind of an idea. I mean, it's really a spooky company. They collect data. Their product is information that they sell once they've collected it. They collect data on groups, on people, on institutions. They have a vast and growing database of everything about you and about companies and all of that. They have, in the past 2 years, gotten, past year especially, but in the past 2 years, gotten heavily involved in providing data to the U.S. government and to other governments around the world. Their methods are sometimes quite subtle. So, for example, for several years on Facebook, you might see a little fun quiz. Find out who your spirit animal is. Find out your ancestry. Find out about what kind of a person you are. And you take these quizzes and they give you a little certificate. They show a little certificate about what they have identified your characteristics of some kind are. That was Palantir working with Facebook to profile you. They got easily tens of millions of profiles from those seemingly innocuous quizzes that they were giving to people, all with the help of Meta, that is Facebook. They are in every aspect of your lives. They are collecting information from the cookies in your computer. They're collecting information from getting access to what you think are private databases. They are essentially the ultimate in Big Brother. And they are the future of information profiling. They put people into categories. They find that there are, I've heard numbers, 50 different types of people, and everyone on Earth fits into one of those profiles by the dimensions of the person's personality and purchasing characteristics and all that. You use coupons at the store, you're providing them with information. Your bank statements telling exactly where you spend money with your debit card, that's information. It becomes part of your profile. You notice more and more that if you look at something on Amazon, ads for that show up on different websites. In the last few months, many people are now reporting that even conversations that they're having that aren't written, suddenly they'll see ads that are related to those conversations on websites you visit. That's where it is now, and Palantir is the forefront of that. If that doesn't scare you, well, anyway, let's talk about investment. Let's ignore the morality or the ethics of it, and let's just look at it as an investment. As you can see, as with all high technology companies, Palantir has a high beta, a 1.54. That's professional level. That's the risk that a pro will take. An average investor probably should not be playing in this world because the volatility is really serious. Now, a couple of other little hallmarks that I want to bring up along the way here is that this is a profitable company. It's not huge. It's 43 cents per share earnings. So in other words, the price divided by earnings is positive. So that means earnings is positive. So they are profitable now. Other things that are along the way are the, they don't pay a dividend. So the only way you make money on this stock is if the stock goes up in price. There's no dividend check in the mail because you're a shareholder. You won't get one. All you can do is buy the stock and hope that it goes up in price. Now, the next thing. P.E. ratio is 369.81. Now, keep in mind that I have stipulated that we should really look at the average industry P.E. ratio, and I'll show you that on Monday. I've got a sheet that you can pull down for yourself. But as a general rule, a price-earnings ratio above 30 means one thing, and below 30 means the opposite. So in a case like this, if you see, look at Palantir with what was that? 369 or so, 370, that price earnings ratio tells you something right off the bat. Can you tell me what it's telling me? Well, no. It's about valuation of the company. Let's try it this way. And it just irritates me to no end. Get off me. Try to turn that off. Okay. Does anyone know what that means? A stock that is below with a PE ratio below 30 is undervalued. A stock with a price with a PE ratio above 30 is overvalued relative to intrinsic value. Now again, you would probably want to refine that to say, well, in this industry, it's 40 or it's 25 or whatever. But using just as a rule of thumb, 30 as the fulcrum between overvalued and undervalued. What would you say in this company? Is this company overvalued or undervalued? Insanely overvalued. This company is so overvalued. I mean, its name should be Kanye. It is, or something like that. It is so overvalued, it is ridiculous. It is overvalued, but you see this overvaluation in a lot of high-tech companies. It is a hallmark of them that they are ridiculously overvalued. Let me show you real quick here. Let's take Tesla, TSLA, with a PE ratio of 295.70. Let's look at NVIDIA. With a price earnings ratio of 47. That isn't that bad. I mean, it was way up there a while back. But you'll see in these high-tech companies, a lot of them are just beyond belief. Now, does that mean that they are going to fall in price back toward intrinsic real soon? Absolutely not. Companies can stay highly overvalued for days, months, even years. And there are a couple of reasons why that happens, and I'll mention that in a minute, why. But just because it's overvalued, yes, in the long run, they will find intrinsic value, but not today and probably not tomorrow, and maybe not for 10 years. Here's one of the big reasons, and it has to do with the investors. A lot of these high-tech companies and these expensive companies like Tesla, the large houses on Wall Street have invested billions of dollars into these companies buying stock in them. If those stock prices collapsed, that would pretty much wipe out the balance sheets of a large percentage of the houses on the street. They have every incentive in the world to keep buying that stock, to keep that price propped up. Because if they ever step back, it would go down and they would go down with it because they are too heavily invested in it. That's why they will, if there's a downturn in the stock price, they will be right in there to buy the hell out of it to get that stock price to stop falling. That's how it works. They support these overvalued companies because they are part of those companies are essentially a significant part of their balance sheets. And because they mark to market, in other words, they actually on the sheet have to say not what they bought it at, but what its current price is. They can't afford to have that current price go down into the toilet because with it would drag the whole balance sheet and the company and the house would fold. So these price to earnings ratios up there in the stratosphere, yeah, they sure are telling us that it's overvalued, but at the same time, they're not going to let it go down to intrinsic because that dropping from 300 down to 30 just ain't going to happen, because the only way price to earnings would go from 300 to 30 is if the price went way down. So that's what we're facing with these price earnings ratios. Yes, they can tell us overvalued, undervalued, but at the same time, when you're talking about companies at this scale, probably not going to be able to trade on that information unless you are a very long-term investor. In the long run, they'll go down, but not for a long, long time, because the houses on Wall Street have too much vested interest in keeping them overvalued for as long as they can, for as long as they need to. So, taking this back to the Palantir. Palantir is, you're going to see something about its balance sheet. Rather, its income statement. But first, I need to show you where we find that information. For every public company must report its financial statements on a regular basis, quarterly and annually, to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, the Securities and Exchange Commission is supposed to make those statements public. That's part of its job, is to create that transparency, which is so fundamental to functioning efficient markets. Everyone has to be able to see everything about that company if it's public. And they can't hide anything. They used to lie on the financial statements all the time, but finally the lies caught up with them, and we had a couple of catastrophes like Enron and WorldCom. And now the rules are very strict about telling the truth on those financial statements. Okay, the system, I was back when I was doing this kind of work, I would actually do the reports to the SEC. We did them on paper. This was decades ago. We did them on paper in triplicate. It was all kinds of craziness, getting the numbers together, getting the narratives together, putting it together, copying it in triplicate down at what was called, at a plate copy center called Kinko's, and then ship them off. Then they came up with an electronic system, and I was one of the pilot consultants who tried out this electronic system. So you no longer had to do paper. You did it in a language, sort of like a web language. It was called SGML. It worked, and then eventually all financial statements were reported in this Edgar system. And the Edgar system just automatically cranked them into a form so that anyone could look at them. Until last year. I pulled up Edgar to get the financial statements of a company, and Edgar no longer lets you see them. Now, I found out there are a couple of scripts to get around it, but now the SEC no longer makes it easy to see financial statements of public corporations. So they're out of the picture. However, there are private resources that you can, from which you can get financial statements, and I'm going to show you the best of them right now. They are supposed to have shown this to you in Business 100 in the Milner Library Research Project, but I am quite sure that if you're a normal person, that went in one ear and out the other. So okay, let me start with this. There are these professional databases. Databases of articles, databases of numbers, databases of anything you could possibly want. However, they are behind paywalls. That's why when you go to an artificial intelligence, like a ChatGPT, to get numbers, they can't go behind paywalls. They'll just find some open internet site, which is unreliable, or even worse, and this happens all the time, they just make up their own numbers. It's called a hallucination in AI parlance. They'll just make up numbers. We can't rely on Google or any other search engine to find us information. I can't even rely on Yahoo. It's a free site. I can guarantee you. See over here, I could get the financials right here on Palantir. I don't do that because I know very well that that is not reliable. It is not what professionals demand. It's just what anyone can go to that. Well, it's free. No, that's the problem. Wikipedia, Investopedia, all of these open websites, they can't, and they will not tell you the right numbers. And I've caught Yahoo on quite a few occasions giving numbers that just were not correct compared to what the company actually reported. That's why here at our university, Illinois State University, they make those paid websites, those with a paywall, freely open to you and to me as a faculty member, as because we are people of ISU. Once you're no longer a student, you can't get to these. You'll just run right into the paywall. But while you're a student here and while I'm a professor here, we've got all of these awesome places we can go. Now, I'm going to bring over here are, by the way, on this side are some of the best of these paid websites. Nexus Uni, if you want anything that's legal, cases, anything about corporate, civil, you name it, criminal, it's there in Nexus Uni. And then they've got ProQuest, Business Source Complete. And then they still show the Edgar system here. Although you go there, you're not going to find, they won't let you go through to find the actual financial statements. The one that is the go-to of the professional world for anything financial whatsoever is the Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage, S&P Global Net Advantage. Now, the website for this is up here, and I'm going to read it, say it letter by letter for the podcast. And here we go, just so that if you are listening to it, you can get to this place. It's GUIDES dot LIBRARY dot LLINOIS STATE.edu/BUS100/SPGLOBAL. This will take you to the gate of the Standard & Poor's, the S&P Global Net Advantage. You go down here and you'll see a link, S&P Global Net Advantage. Now, once you click on that, it's going to check your credentials to see if you are a paying subscriber. Because you're a student here, you are a paying subscriber. But be aware that once you step into the portal, it may take a minute to get you over to the Global Net Advantage, because it is being used all the time by tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of professionals every day. So we're going to click on it, and the first thing it will do is for you to declare your credentials. Actually, I did this in last class, so probably already knows them. But the first time you do it, there'll be a please wait or something like that while I get you in, but I was already logged in. So here we are over here. Welcome Illinois State University dashboard. In other words, ISU is a subscriber and you are part of ISU. Now, the first thing you'll notice is that this looks kind of boring. This is a really lame website. You go up here to this red Net Advantage and there's a little box beside it. Type in the trading symbol of the company you want to look at. Now, you can type in the name of the company, but you've got to be a little careful with that because sometimes companies have the same name and you might not get the one you want that way. I found that out the hard way some years back when I typed in Sears. But if you type in the, you'll get to it. Now, when you hit enter, what's going to happen is suddenly the world opens up. Each of these is a page of data, some of it numerical, some of it otherwise. So for example, I can get things like the income statement and balance sheet, statement of cash flows. I can get who the board members are and I can see their resumes. I can go up here. In a week or so, I'm going to be teaching you how to get financial ratios. This site gives them to you. It's almost like, that's why anymore I ask questions about ratios, but I don't even ask you to calculate them anymore, because you can get them from the global net advantage. Every ratio that you could possibly want from the financial statements. They've got anything that you could possibly imagine. Also, analyses of the company by some of the greatest minds in our field that'll give it to you. I'm showing you this for my purposes and yours for this class, but I'm also pointing out to you, this is a candy store of information for projects, for term papers that you may have to write before you're finished here at ISU. You go here, and this is an authoritative citation that you can do. You can download spreadsheets of numbers. They let you download the spreadsheets. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go up here, and I'm just going to click on income statement here, if I can find it. Well, watch what happens when I do that. Oh, come on. Stupid tiny print. I can't see. There's the income statement. I apologize there. Okay, there's the income statement. Now, a couple of things. The first thing is that Palantir is on a fiscal year that's the calendar year. They have not yet posted their latest calendar year, 2025. So the 2025 data you see will be an estimate. Companies don't have to report a year's data. I think it's still not for 90 days after the fiscal year ends. So in this case, you probably wouldn't see this company's authentic actual numbers for 2025 until maybe March. Some companies get it in really fast, like in early February, but a lot of companies delay until they have to file it. But a couple of things to guide you here. First things first, click on the more options. That'll give you a few more things you can do. Now, I prefer 2 decimal places of accuracy. As you see, it defaults to 1. I like 2. Some people like 4. You can get as many decimal places of accuracy as you want. Another thing is that I prefer the most recent year on the left, the latest year on the left. That's just me. Some of you might prefer it the other way, but I like it, the newest one right here on the left side. And then when you've made your preference choices, just hit go, and then there they are for you, the way you want them. Now, the next thing that you can do here is, if you look up here, you'll see some selections. Download financials. Okay, we can, and there'll be an Excel sheet. And once you're in Excel, you can do a lot of things. You can do side calculations. You can make graphs. As a matter of fact, you can even make graphs here if you know how to work this thing. You can make a graph of the revenues or a graph of the net income or whatever you want. But I'm just going to download the financial statements. And we will wait for them completed. Palantir. Now here's what you're going to get. No, quit that. Stop that. Okay, enable editing. You get their income statement. Look at this. You get income statement, balance sheet, cash flow, statement of cash flows, and they even throw in the ratios that I'm going to teach you how to do next week that you don't have to do because you've got the stupid S&P Global Net Advantage that does it for you. It's all there in and they're yours. You save it, and then you can use it for your purposes, do clips of it. Make sure that if you're going to use it in a paper that you just you cite to Global Standard Poor's Global Net Advantage. Just say, you know, source and all that kind of stuff. But as you can see, we've got 5 years of data just perfectly strung out for your enjoyment, financial statements. And you can get this for any public company. And that makes, that is a big thing for doing research. You're using an important source, virtually a primary source. It is not in, on the open internet where all kinds of fun can be done to things. It's behind a paywall. It is highly respected in industry and academia, unlike Wikipedia and all of those kinds of places. So here we go. Just to carry this through here. Now, I'll tell you a story. Just sounds like it has nothing to do with this. Now, oh, I'm trying to think someone who looks, okay. You are my officer in the United States Army. Fortunately, I didn't have you because my officer because you're a beast. But you say, all right, men, and I use that term loosely, we're going to attack at dawn. And I raise, do you know what it looks like where we're going to attack? Shut up! You see, the thing, though, is that you didn't do any recon. You didn't look at the field of the battle. You didn't just stand there and say, oh, well, there's some hills and there's some rocks we could hide behind. All that. You see, that's important. Before you ever attack numbers, you look at them in a larger way. What am I seeing here? So I would put it to you, sir. Look at Palantir. Is Palantir a growing company? Is it healthy? If you look at the revenue, looks like it. Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, over the past 5 years, that company has grown by more than 100%. It's of like 150, it's grown, it's more than doubled its revenue in just 5 years. That is the first evidence that you have a strong company. Just look at the numbers without, I mean, I can calculate percentage growth rates and all that, the ending minus beginning divided by the beginning and all that. Well, why do I do that? I can just look at it and see, yes, this is a company that is growing, and it is growing fast and hard. The next thing is I can look at the cost of goods sold, and I notice, well, they're growing too at about the same pace. So they're not having costs get out, their biggest operating costs getting out of control. Just looking at the numbers before you do any number calculations on Excel or on a calculator. Now, looking down here. Now, selling general, now, by the way, cost of goods sold is an operating cost. That's what we care about in finance. What is bringing in money and what is taking out money from operations? Now, if I look at the down here, selling general and administrative expenses, SG&A, you'll see me put it sometimes. These are operating expenses. This is your wages and salaries, your light bill, your utility bills, light bills and all that, advertising expenses, stuff of meals and entertainment, all postage and handling and all that kind of stuff. Great. That is an operating cost. I can look at those and I can see that selling general and administrative expenses are not growing as fast. Kind of interesting to see that. R&D expenses, research and development. That is, it's kind of considered an operating cost because that's going to directly affect how your revenue goes. So we put that in there. And you can see that it is growing, but it's certainly, at least as far as I can see, it's not double, it didn't double. So in other words, they are doing R&D, but it's not excessive R&D. Now, this one down here, depreciation and amortization. That is not an operating cost, but we call it that just so we can put it, because it does have an effect on cash flow. Because when I take away that depreciation, even though depreciation expense doesn't really exist, it does save us some money on our taxes, because we subtract that from our revenues like those other lines there. So it does have a tax shield effect. Ultimately, once we brought into its tax shield effect, then we can subtract the original depreciation and amortization expense back out. But we leave it there long enough for it to do its thing with saving us some money on taxes. Okay, other operating expenses, they don't have any. So now, operating income. Now that, in some financials, you hear that called EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, or something like that. So, but you'll hear me use that. A term that you'll hear me use for those lines from SG&A down to other operating expenses, you'll hear me use the term OPEX. OPEX, OPEX, for that. It's just some jargon. Saves us using too many syllables. Okay. Now, interest expense is actually has two faces to it. You are a lender to me. I owe you $500,000 in interest expense for all those millions of dollars you've lent me. Okay, that's good. However, I also lend you money, another corporation, and you owe me $100,000 in interest expense on the loans that I've given you. So you have to take the balance of the $500,000 I paid to someone and the $100,000 in interest expense that was paid to me. And that's why you have, there will be two parts to that, and that will create the net interest expense, which in this example I gave here would be $400,000 out the door. However, interest expense is not an operating expense. It does not affect operations. You will never pay an interest check to your lenders and say, boy, that'll make us produce more of our product today. It's just a dead weight, not operating. It's just a dead weight. So now we bring it down here, got some lines, impairments and all that. And eventually, you get to the much desired income tax expense. And I'll get to that more in just a little bit here. It's one of those things that I really don't like to do, and I will do it in a summary fashion. But we finally get to net income of the company. Notice something interesting about net income. You see how they were losing money until they weren't losing money anymore. They have become so essential to the functioning of government and business anymore, with all the information products that they can provide about you, me, everybody, that they are not going to ever want for a profit again. They are that popular, and the sky is the limit for their growth, because information is so valuable. It is the most important product of the 21st century. And not just abstract information, actionable information about you, me, everybody else. Have you ever gone on Amazon or someplace like that to look at something, and then you saw ads show up on other websites? That's Palantir. Those cookies in your computer, they go in and they go get those cookies. And then they'll be able to tell where you've been, what you've been doing, naughty you, and all of that. In fact, in the last couple of months, there have been a lot of credible reports, people saying, I had an ad show up on a website, and all I did was talk to someone about that product. Oh yeah, they are listening, and that becomes part of your profile. They can hear you. And no, that's not some conspiracy theory. It's just your voice, and what you say is information. And you better believe they'll find a way to get that information from your mobile phone and from your Alexa or from your other whatever device you have around you, they'll get it. And so this company has no limit to what it can make selling that to the highest bidders. I just thought I'd tell you that just to make you sleep a little less easily tonight. But anyway, okay, good news on this. We got the income statement. Now let's have a look quick here over on the balance sheet. The balance sheet is, remember, the reservoir. What happened at the end of where we were at the end of the year? And a couple of things to bring up. And part of this is my bias toward the short term because I teach our short-term financial management course, but it's important for us here, is because the ebb and flow of actual cash, not accounting numbers, but the actual cash of a business is driven in large part from day to day, week to week, month to month, by the current assets and liabilities. What's happening in the here and now? So we have the current assets, CA, and the current liabilities, CL. These are the liquid part of the financial statements. Now, I am about to give you a definition. And this is not the definition that you would get on the open internet. You Google the word liquidity, or you go to Wikipedia, or to Investopedia, or to any one of a number of other cesspools, and you will get a slightly, but importantly, different definition. Here's the right one. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, on the open internet, you'll see a slightly different definition. You will see liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted to cash. That's flawed for two things. One is the open internet definition uses the word ease instead of efficiency. Ease means nothing. Financially, efficiency means at the lowest cost. So the right definition uses efficiency, not ease. And then that last word, I said converted to another asset. The open internet uses the term cash, can be converted into cash. Well, that can't be a good definition because then you couldn't define cash and its liquidity because you'd be defining cash in terms of cash. So you want to say it is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. That might be cash, it might be another asset, but you can't use cash. Now, I give this on a quiz, and then, of course, I give you a chance to use the bad definition, and then I know that you're using the internet instead of the lecture. So beware of that one on a quiz, hint, hint. Okay, here we go. Now, current assets and current liabilities, they are liquid. They happen within a year or so. Now, on the current asset side, you will see accounts receivable, if I can spell right here. It was receivable, you'll see inventory, and you might see a few more like prepaid expenses, things like that. Those are the big ones. Now, on the current liability side, the biggest one is accounts payable. Sometimes you'll see wages payable, and you'll also see maybe wages payable. You might also see current portion of long-term debt. In other words, what you owe on your long-term debt in the next year or so. The by far the biggest, though, is accounts payable, usually. Now, here's the thing about these. We have a measure of the net of these current assets against current liabilities. We call it net working capital, NWC. Net working capital, NWC. This is just current assets minus current liabilities. Now, later I will kind of tighten this to talk about current operating assets minus current operating liabilities. Just to tighten it down to operations instead of fluff that isn't involved in the actual operations of the company. But for right now, this is fine for us. Now, let's work on this. What does this mean in terms of cash flow? Okay, give you an example. I'm going to give you an example from my own business. I sell one of my artworks for $1,200. Which is about what I've done in a number of situations, $1,200. Okay, now, a lot of people couldn't afford that right off the bat. They love what I'm doing, they love it, they want it, they know where they would put it, but they can't pay $1,200. They've come to some stupid arts and crafts shows with maybe a few hundred in their pocket. So what I do is I offer them credit terms. Okay, you pay me $400 now, and $800 is due within 6 months. And I go through PayPal system or another system to do it. Okay, great. On my income statement, I have said that I made $1,200. I have to put the price of it. However, I did not make $1,200. I made $400. The rest was accounts receivable, went up by $1,200, which means that in relative to my revenue statement, I lost $800. So in other words, whenever a current asset goes up, free cash flow goes down. The same is true with inventory. When inventory goes up, I've spent money out of cash to do that, and so my free cash flow goes down by the amount of that inventory that I put on credit. So current assets going up is going to cause free cash flow to be damaged. However, when my customer pays the $800, my accounts receivable, part of current assets, goes down. And of course, that means my free cash flow goes up by that amount. So this is not the income statement. The income statement recognizes the cost and the revenue and the cost as it was stated. But that's not really what happened. In finance, we need to know what really happened. Now, take it on the current liability side. Current liability side. You, madam, work for me. I work you to the bone, but I pay you well. $50 a week. I'm a giver. Okay? However, you come to me on Friday and I say, I'll catch up with you on that check next week sometime. You see, on my financial statement for that Friday, I'm going to write you $50 that I paid you. But I didn't really. That went into my accounts payable, my wages payable. In other words, the current liability went up, and so that caused my free cash flow available to me to go up because I said I paid you $50, but I actually kept it. So my free cash flow has gone up relative to what I reported. You follow it? But then next week, you come to me on Wednesday and you say, fat boy, 50, you know? Fine, here's your damn money. So then the accounts payable, the wages payable goes down by $50. Current liability goes down by $50. And that, of course, made my free cash flow go down for the week by $50. Put those in your notes because that will make it pretty easy for you to answer a question on a quiz like, okay, we sold something for $800 and $500 of it was on credit. What happened to free cash flow? Just use that chart, that little chart right there, and you're in business. You're fine with it. Now, one thing that I do want to show you here, we'll do more of this next week because we're still stuck. Oh, that's right. Why don't you log into Attendance Radar, get your, while I pull up something here. And while you're doing that, I did. I actually kept it on the screen instead of closing it. Now, this is kind of a minor point right now, but it is hugely important to the distinction between accounting and finance. Now, down there on the balance sheet, in the long-term, current liabilities, long-term liabilities, you get to the stockholders' equity. Now, if you look there, on that balance sheet is reported the total value of ownership in the company according to accounting principles consistently applied. Yes, that right there, yeah. Okay, $6.590 billion. That's what the income balance sheet says, the total value of the shareholders' ownership is. Now let me show you what the market says the total value of Palantir's ownership is. It's right. Where the heck is it? There. Let me kind of expand that a little bit. $377.918 billion. Do you see a slight difference between what the market values the company's ownership as and what the accountants value the ownership of the company as? See a little bit of a difference? It's an insanely huge difference. The market is what will determine the true value. The accountants have to follow their rules, but the market is where the reality is. If you go to buy a share of stock, are you going to buy it from your accountant or are you going to buy it from the market? And a broker in the market. That's the vast difference. We can't be using the accounting statements to tell the truth, the reality of a corporation. We have to let the market do it. Well, the market could be wrong. That's whatever. You've got a shark coming at you and it's going to eat you. You say to that shark, you are wrong. The shark is still going to eat you, and that's the market. The market is where you will live and die, where your pension will be great or will go into insolvency, where your savings for your retirement will be made in investments. The market determines. That's why we cannot use the accounting statements without distinctly modifying what they are reporting. Now, as I had said earlier, and I try to put this off as long as possible, a note about taxes. And I'm just going to give you a couple of quick things. First of all, from the beginning of taxes up until the early 1960s, the top marginal tax rate was on corporations and on rich people was 90%. That would be, of course, you know, the end of the universe for corporations now screaming for lower taxes. Yeah, they were that high. And we grew after the World War II with 90% tax rates on corporations at 90 to 91%. Now, corporations bitched and they cried about it, but they also understood something, that all of that money they were paying was going into that road system that we all see to this day. They were going into the telephone lines. They were going into all of these projects, these dams that would generate hydropower. It was all being done to grow a nation that desperately wanted to grow and be the true leader of the free world. And it stayed that way. But they did come down to 70% because of the fussing and bitching of corporate powers. But they stayed high like that through the growth of the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s. They went down dramatically to, quote-unquote, help get us out of a recession in 1982, when the top marginal tax rate on corporations dropped to 39%. Where they stayed until 2017, when the dream come true of corporate America got a 21% flat rate. Now, the rate before that was progressive. Each dollar more you earned had a higher tax rate on it. But now it is a flat 21% on corporate profits with a lot of loopholes. That is the exclusive reason you are now facing in your lifetimes deficits and budget deficits and a national debt that are staggering beyond belief, approaching $40 trillion, is it, that you owe, because we cut tax rates so much that there is not anywhere near enough money to pay our bills. And where did we get the money to pay our bills? We borrowed it. From whom did we borrow it? From the Chinese, the Japanese, the Europeans. That's where we borrow the money to live beyond our means. Now, there was an attempt and there was talk that it would be cut even further, down to 15%. But the political thinking now is that the White House is just becoming too politically weak to get the Congress to pass that even lower rate. Okay, take that off the board. When you see a tax to be applied in calculating free cash flow, if I don't say anything else, it's 0.21, 21%. The next thing is that there is a limit. See that interest expense that's subtracted there before taxes are calculated? The company cannot deduct more than 30% of its gross income. I think that's the number now. So in other words, you can deduct interest expense from your taxable income only up to the point where it's 30%. Then anything after that, you can't subtract for tax calculation purposes. Now, the last one, and I don't believe the book brings this one up, but it is hugely important. Corporations pay dividends. To you and me, we put those down as just ordinary income. It's taxable at the ordinary tax rate that we pay. With corporations that own stock of other corporations, the dividends that they get, a significant portion of those are tax-free. So in other words, I own shares of your company. I'm a corporation, I own shares of yours. You pay me a dividend. I don't have to pay tax on a lot of that dividend. It's tax-free. This is the primary reason that we are now in an era when corporations are buying the stock of each other so that they can flow money through dividends to each other that have a significant component that is not taxed. This is why right now our best estimate is that ownership in corporations by other corporations constitutes about 75% of all ownership of corporations. They own each other. We don't own them. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.